Joining me now is Jonathan Capehart, opinion writer for The Washington Post and an MSNBC contributor. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Leonard.
Was this a more partisan speech than the one he gave 4 years ago?
I think given the 4 years we've just gone through, I could see how you would come up with that characterization, sort of the president's talking about how science proves that climate change is real, how his, you know, talking about the takers versus the makers argument that some within the Republican Party, particularly Congressman Paul Ryan, the 2012 Republican vice presidential nominee, is known to have said many, many times, both on the campaign trail and just as a member of Congress. So in that regard, yes, it was partisan in that way. But I go back to what I was saying before the president's speech, that overall, this was a speech that hovered in the 35,040-foot level, where the president spent more time talking about who we are as a people and what he thinks our priorities should be in terms of caring for the poor, caring for the sick and the elderly, but also investing in future generations to ensure that the good fortune that we have, we have benefited from and have sustained for decades now continues on. So I think maybe we'll talk after the State of the Union address in a couple of weeks and compare the two speeches to see which one is more partisan than the other. And I guarantee you that the State of the Union address will be much more partisan.
Well, there was a lot of rhetoric, but he also seemed to mention a lot of the important issues. Were you surprised that the president put Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security front and center during the speech? He offered a strong defense of the social safety net, and we have a little clip, which we will play in just a moment.
The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative, they strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great.
So that was pretty strong, in the light of what we saw during the presidential campaign.
Sure. And I mentioned that. I mentioned that in my earlier answer. And to be quite honest, when I heard him go that, you know, so forcefully, in that clip that you just played, it raised my eyebrows, because that was the one time in a few, maybe two or three other times, when President Obama's sort of rhetorical plane dipped down from the 40,000-foot level and came down into a bit of partisan rhetoric. But I think when we go back and we look at what the president had to say, this was a speech that was trying to remind all of us of, one, who we are as a country, but who he is as president and where he wants to take the country.
Were you surprised by the prominent place he put on climate change? The president didn't address it in legislation in his first term, as many hoped that he would, but here's what he said.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms.
Should that give environmentalists hope that there'll be a push for climate change legislation in his second term?
Well, absolutely. You know, presidential speeches, whether it's the inaugural or joint session of Congress speech or State of the Union address, every word is considered. Every paragraph, every sentence is considered. And so for the president to give climate change such prominence in his speech should give them hope. Let's keep in mind, the president did back a climate change bill that only made its way through the House. And if you talk to House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, she will tell you that she got her members to vote for a climate change bill, and that it hurt her members, and potentially along with the health care bill, led to the defeat of Democrats holding on to the House in the 2010 midterm elections. I think what the president is saying here is sort of signaling that among all the priorities that we already know he is working on and wants to work on, immigration, gun control, continuing to get the economy thriving more than it is, as you know, he said in his speech, it's coming back now, but he wants it to thrive even more and put more people back to work, that climate change is indeed part of the program of what he wants to get done in the second term. Many people have criticized the president for not talking about it at all on the campaign trail, not talking about it at all in any post-election remarks. I think anyone who thinks that it's not a priority for him, now he's given them reason to believe that he really will push for climate change legislation or do more than he's already doing in that regard. And I'm thinking about all the fuel economy standards that he has pushed through. When he couldn't get a climate change bill through, he did what he could do on the regulatory side. And so now you're seeing fuel economy standards at heights that I don't think many environmentalists thought could ever be reached.
And there was a bit of a back of the hand to senators like Tom Coburn, who doubt the scientific evidence of climate change.
Well, right. Tom Coburn and lots of people up on the Hill in the House and the Senate are questioning climate change, but they're also reflecting constituents back home. There are people in this country who do not believe that there's any scientific basis for the belief of climate change, that, you know, global warming is not real. And so the president, you know, using the bully pulpit, using the authority of being president, is saying that, one, climate change is real, two, science backs it up, and three, he's going to do as much as he can to do something about it.
He called for marriage equality, which is interesting for a president who just declared his support for gay marriage over the summer. Let's hear what he had to say about that.
Our journey is not complete until our gay brothers and sisters are treated like anyone else under the law. For if we are truly created equal, then surely the love we commit to one another must be equal as well.
Many people feel he was pushed into taking that position in the first place by something that Joe Biden said, but he seems to have embraced it rather wholeheartedly since.
Well, I mean, to back up on the history of, yes, Vice President Biden, as the president said, went out over his skis in saying what he felt and what he believed. If you talk to, from my reporting, with folks in the White House, the president was within a week of making his own public declaration of where he stood on the issue. And that Vice President Biden, knowing what the president was going to do, Joe being Joe, got out there ahead of the president. But if you look at the president's deeds, leave aside his words up until that point when he had the interview with Robin Roberts of ABC News back in May, the president's deeds all spoke to a president who believed in equality for lesbian and gay, bisexual and transgender Americans. The problem was that the words did not match. And by coming out personally in favor of marriage equality, he had the words match the deeds. This, what the president did in his inaugural speech today, goes, you know, I think, light years ahead of where anyone in the gay community would ever expect. I mean, I had no clue, had no inkling that this is what he would do, that he would be so forthright in embracing the LGBT community, so forthright in speaking about how that community needs to be made whole and be made whole in having their relationships recognized under the law as equal as everyone else's. I think tomorrow, well, starting now, but certainly tomorrow, I think the nation will be engaged in a conversation about what it means to have a president of the United States to be so bold in embracing and accepting of a section of the American public that is still pushing for equality in a whole host of areas, not just in marriage equality, but employment non-discrimination and other areas. I think you know, as I mentioned before, when we were talking just after his speech, that for me was probably one of the most powerful moments in his speech. Probably because, you know, as a gay American, it affects me greatly to hear a president of the United States recognize and acknowledge a part of me that is very important. And so right now I kind of feel sort of, I don't know, complete as an African American, seeing another African American take the oath of office for a second time is really something that is quite moving, quite powerful, and gives me hope that there will be another one, you know, as qualified and as historic as this one. But to then hear this black man acknowledge another part of me is something that I won't soon forget.
And as you mentioned earlier, he tied Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall together in that speech. When we come back from a little break, I want to look into that part of his speech a little more and talk about some of the other aspects of this inauguration. I'm talking with Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post and MSNBC, also an irregular contributor to this show, but one who is always welcome. We'll be right back with you, Jonathan, after this. We are back with Jonathan Capehart, opinion writer for The Washington Post and a contributor to MSNBC. And we are talking about the president's inauguration speech. He used the refrain, "We the people," throughout the speech. Was he providing a framework, a kind of social contract for his second term?
I noticed that, too. I mean, and it was always "we," pause, "the people." Yes, I think the president is making it clear to everyone that it's not just him as president who has work to do. It's we, the people, who have a lot of work to do on a whole host of issues, a whole host of areas, to ensure that this great enterprise that is America keeps going forward. And at the end, towards the end of this of his speech, is when he really gave the clarion call for everyone to stand up and be a part of making the change that they so want. I'm trying to find the transcript on one of my windows on my computer, and I can't find it. But at the moment, but you know, when I heard him say that, I mean, what we have seen the president do, particularly on most recently on gun control, when he accepted Vice President Biden's task force's recommendations for what should be done and what should be pushed either by executive order or congressional action. And at the tail end of his remarks, he, you know, basically gave a call to arms, so to speak, to the American people to get involved, to call their members of Congress, to be a part of helping to push forward the change that he views needs to happen. And I think in this inaugural address, what he said towards the end about, again, sort of another call to arms of the American people, we the people need to be a part of the change that we so want to happen, both in this town but also around the country.
But it's also a way of addressing the polarization that has pretty much been the norm in Washington for quite a while.
Yes, and you know, this gets back to something I was about to say before Vice President Biden popped up to take his oath. You know, the president and the vice president, they've had a rough 4 years trying to deal with a recalcitrant Republican opposition. The first 2 years with the Democrats in control of the House and marginally for a little bit, the Senate not being able to get a whole lot of things done. After the midterm elections, things got worse. A Republican opposition where the Senate Minority Leader said that, you know, his number one goal was to ensure that the president was a one-term president, and the well was just poisoned from there. I think what we're seeing now is that the president understanding and his administration understanding and realizing that while the president has the bully pulpit, it's the American people through their voices, through their phone calls, through their however they reach out to their members of Congress, that that is the way they're going to, if not change the ways of Washington, at least push through the partisan gridlock to try to get things done. I think it's a much more clear-eyed and realistic view of trying to get things done here in Washington, as opposed to what many people thought was a naive view of the president 4 years ago, that just through force of personality and just because he said so, that that the partisan gridlock would just melt away.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, he evoked Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall, pivotal moments in the women's movement, the civil rights movement, and the gay rights movement. And let's listen to what he said.
We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still. Just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints along this great mall, to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth.
It's interesting that that comes in the light of his replacement of Reverend Louis Giglio after controversy erupted over the anti-gay sermon that he gave back in the 1990s. In the first inauguration, Rick Warren gave the benediction, and he also had made anti-gay remarks. Some people feel that at times the president is a bit tone deaf.
Yes. Well, the first go-round with Rick Warren, you know, the president was trying to be true to his word about being inclusive, about agreeing to disagree or not disagreeing without being disagreeable. I mean, he caught a lot of grief from me and from others for having this person who had a to be charitable, dim view of gays and lesbians. This go-round with Louis Giglio, it didn't take long for that pastor to pull his name out of, to sort of disinvite himself to the inaugural when the controversy blew up over the sermon he gave back in the 1990s. You know, again, it would have been a horrible disconnect for the president of the United States, given the speech he just gave, to then have someone on the platform who gave a sermon, an anti-gay sermon from the mid-1990s. And, you know, there are people who will say, oh, well, come on, what's the big deal? That was 15 years ago or so. That was a long time ago. Give the guy a break. What about Chuck Hagel? He's got some intemperate things he said about gays and lesbians in his past. And to that, I would say the difference between those two is that Hagel apologized, but also within his apology, Hagel talked about moving things forward. He apologized, and he talked about moving things forward in terms of, if he were to become Secretary of Defense, doing things that would bring about equality for gay and lesbian service members. Louis Giglio, even in his statement, one, he didn't apologize, but two, just tried to downplay what he had said by in his statement, saying that, well, if you've noticed, this is not a focal point of my sermons over the last 15, 20 years. Well, that's just too bad. And to, you know, he was invited from the reporting I did with the Presidential Inaugural Committee because of his work on human trafficking, which is something that is very important to the president, something he talked about at the Clinton Global Initiative last September. So that's how he got on the radar screen. But that one issue, human trafficking, you know, was not enough to overcome a huge philosophical gap between the president and Louis Giglio. when it comes to gays and lesbians.
Now, the president took his oath, which was a symbolic one today, using two Bibles. He used a third Bible, the Michelle Obama's family Bible, yesterday. These two were Abraham Lincoln, and the other was owned by Martin Luther King Jr. Now, President Obama has often invoked Lincoln's work as president, and this year marks the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Do you think that was one of the reasons they chose that Bible? The King Bible is obvious. Today is Martin Luther King Day.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, the president is a student of history, a lover of history, and since his first inauguration, a symbol of history. I have a piece out right now on WashingtonPost.com on our postpartisan site talking about the historic serendipity of President Obama and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. On August 28th, 1963 was when King gave his famous speech, I Have a Dream speech, during the March on Washington. What I think a lot of people forget is that 45 years later, to the day, August 28th, 2008, was when Barack Obama accepted the nomination, the Democratic presidential nomination in Denver, the first African-American to win a major political party's presidential nomination. And as we all know, he went on to win. Now, when he was inaugurated in 2009, it fell within the MLK holiday weekend. The holiday was on the Monday, but the inauguration was on the Tuesday. Here we are 4 years later, where the confluence of history is just incredible, where the second inauguration of the first black president falls on the actual day of the holiday. So for all of that to have happened, and for the president to take the oath of office with the Lincoln Bible, the man who freed the slaves, and the King Bible, the man who helped free this country from the grip of bigotry and intolerance, an ongoing struggle, I might add, the King struggle, is a very powerful, powerful thing to have witnessed.
Another confluence is that March on Washington was organized by Bayard Rustin,
correct,
who was often criticized for being gay. So we have come a fair way, at least as far as official Washington is concerned, in addressing those issues. For the first time since the beginning of the 2008 campaign, none of the president's closest advisors will be working in the White House. Do you think that will bring a different tone to the White House?
Oh, sure. You know, the first term is, you know, the people who've been with you from the very beginning, the people you know and you trust and who know you very, very well. The second term, you know, those folks are tired. Those folks are moving on and will be out of the White House, will not, the president won't be able to see them at the drop of a hat or a moment's notice. Of course, you know, there's email and cell phones. But the second term will bring about a sort of new tenor and new mood, both from the president, but also from the administration, as you have the next wave of advisors and cabinet secretaries and undersecretaries come through and work with this president on his second and final term.
Although most of them, as has been pointed out, white men with connections to the establishment.
Yeah, I hear that, but the president's nominations are not complete. And, you know, the idea that when I hear that criticism of the president, something else that I wrote about last week, it sort of ignores the fact that there are still key women in the Obama administration who are at the helm of some very important policy initiatives for the president. Kathleen Sebelius, Health and Human Services Secretary, who was there at the implementation, the cobbling together, the formation of the health care law. She's going to be there when that law is fully implemented.
Jonathan,
in 2014.
Thank you so much for being with us again. Jonathan Capehart is opinion writer for The Washington Post and a contributor to MSNBC.